very upset when he saw people who wouldn't hold to the Erev, and he'd start talking to them about Erev, and they didn't know anything about what an Erev is. So why are you taking on astringency? Everyone else is holding of an Erev. So what's the basis for taking on astringency you don't begin to understand? People take on all kinds of stringencies they don't understand. The Mishnah Berurah says one of the reasons he compiled the Mishnah Berurah, Chafetz Chaim says, is so that people, when they take on stringencies, they'll know what stringencies make sense. Sometimes people think they're taking on a stringency and really it's a leniency. So the Mishnah Berurah says, people don't know, so I'm putting together Mishnah Berurah. So whoever wants to be stringent could be stringent in a fashion that makes sense, and he's really being stringent. We had a person who decided they're going to be very stringent on Chalav Yisrael. They're not eating anything that's not Chalav Yisrael. They're entitled to do that, but there are strong halachic opinions that say it's perfectly okay in the United States to eat stuff that isn't Chalav Yisrael. So when this person went to his parents' house, he wouldn't eat anything. So now he's being stringent on Chalav Yisrael, but at the same time he's being lenient on a mitzvah d'oraisa of Kibbutz Avim. Does that make sense? It's a good question, but he has to ask it. He can't assume because he's being stringent on something that means that he's doing right. A person says, I'm not going to carry in the Erev. Fine. And then when he walks down the steps, he sees a woman with two children in a carriage, and she's barely making it, wobbling down the steps with her two kids in the carriage. So now does it make sense to hold that stringency of not carrying? You could say yes, you could say no, but a person should know what he's talking about. When people just take on stringencies and they don't know, so the question is, why take on the stringency to begin with if you don't begin to know what's going on? And how do you know when to apply it and when not to apply it? And the last point regarding stringencies is that whatever stringency a person takes on, he should make a point of remembering that it's a stringency and should say very clearly to himself, this is a stringency which I'm taking on condition. I will take it when I want it and leave it when I want it. Person should refrain from saying, I'm going to do this stringency. When a person does take on a chumrah stringency, a person is entitled to say, I'll do it at home, I'll do it when I feel like it, I'll do it. It's a stringency. So you could define when you're doing it. It's not the halacha. To eat kosher, you always have to eat kosher. But if you're going to say, let's say, your rabbi holds you're allowed to eat foods that are with gelatin, right? There are foods that have a hechsher here in Israel, and they say, kasher l'ochlei gelatin. And you say, okay, even though my rabbi holds that's permissible, but I won't do it. So for you, being that your rabbi holds that's permissible, that's a stringency. Your neighbor, his rabbi might hold that's not permissible, so for him, he's not allowed to eat it. He shouldn't eat it ever. But a person whose rabbi holds that it's permissible, so for him, not eating it is a stringency. So then a person should say, I'm taking on that stringency for myself now, when it works for me. And if let's say one time he's hiking up in the Golan and he walks into a store and there's nothing there that he trusts the heksher, but this one thing that's a good heksher, but it says it has gelatin, so then maybe he'll feel like buying that candy bar, and he could. Whenever a person takes on astringency, he should recognize that he doesn't know when he'll be up and when he'll be down and when it'll be easier or more difficult to maintain it, and a person should limit it. Firstly, a person should consider whether he should or should. More often than not, people take on stringencies, and that causes them to lose the main thing, things that aren't stringencies. A person says, I'm going to wake up Vatikin every day. How many times does he wake up and miss Minyan altogether? So what did he gain and what did he lose? Make Minyan and don't go Vatikin every day. It's very nice to go Vatikin, but who says that's worth it? A person says, I'm going to take off all my breaks and learn. And then he finds himself not being able to focus on the time that he's supposed to be learning. So did he really gain? More often than not, when people try to go too high, too quick, they lose from the principle. They don't gain. So first, the person should consider really well whether he wants to take on astringency, whether it makes sense to take on astringency, where it's coming from. We had a guy here who finished Geirus. When he finished Geirus, he came to me and he said, I want to start wearing a hat and jacket. Could you review the halachot of a hat and jacket with me? So I said, I'll review the halachot of a hat and jacket with you, but if you want to know my opinion, don't put on a hat and jacket. So he said, why not? You wear a hat and jacket. So I said, yeah, but all your friends don't wear a hat and jacket. So I would ask myself very strongly why you want to wear a hat and jacket. Because you didn't come here and say, I want to learn the halachot, and if the halacha is that I should, then I will. You said, I want to wear it, and I want to understand why I'm wearing it. So that means you want to wear it, not because you understand that you should. So in that case, chances are it's not stemming from the halacha that you want to wear it, because you don't know the halacha yet. So what's it stemming from? You want to feel more religious. You want to feel certain things. It's good to feel more religious, but you have to ask yourself where it's coming from. Don't put on a hand jacket.
Okay.
They all know I wasn't talking about you. I'm not going to say to put it on or not to put it on, but I'm saying when a person takes on astringency, he has to ask himself, where's that coming from also? Now sometimes we say that a person should do what's right, and he should push himself with less than holy incentives. The Rambam says when a child starts learning, you tell him learn so that you'll get a candy. He learns a little bit more, and you tell him learn, and we'll get you a good meal. He learns a little bit more, and you tell him learn, so you'll become a big rabbi. And then the Rambam says people learn, and you tell him become an even bigger rabbi. You'll become the rabbi of the town. This means he's already learning. He's at the stage where he's becoming a rabbi, and his incentive is going to be, the Rambam says, his incentive is going to be, you'll become the greatest rabbi. One second, aren't we supposed to learn Torah for the sake of learning Torah? God gave us a mitzvah. So the Rambam says, yeah, that's true. A person is supposed to work towards achieving the status of being an Oved Shem Shamayim Lishma, being an Oved Hashem truly. But that takes a lot of work. So sometimes we say use impure incentives in order to get yourself to do what's right. But the question is, what's right or what's astringency? And why am I doing the astringency? And what's the price of the astringency? Etc. Back to Sota. So we said, a husband sees his wife, he sees her, and he's wondering what happened. He feels that something improper is going on. He could warn her. That stage is called kinui. Ba'avar alav ruach kina, a spirit of zealousness overtakes him. The Gemara has two different opinions as to whether that's a positive ruach or a negative ruach. Is that a ruach of tara or not? Two opinions whether there's a mitzvah to tell his wife this or not. Machlokas Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Akiva. When a husband sees his wife in a fashion that he feels that he has reason to be concerned, so there's a machlokas whether it's mitzvah or reshut that he should tell her, don't go alone with that person. And that goes with the opinion, obviously, that it's positive that he tells her this. The other opinion says it's not a good thing, but the Torah gave him an outlet to ensure that this marriage continues if she's pure. After he warns her, if she goes into an area where no one sees her again for a short period of time, and there are witnesses, so he is forbidden to live with her, and he takes her to the court. The court gives him two people. Those two people are there to forewarn him and ensure that he's not alone with her, because if he'll be alone with her, if he'll have marital relations, then there's no point in giving her the water. It won't work. It only works if he was a pure person, then the water will check her. And they travel with them up to the high court in Jerusalem. The high court asks her, and they hear the whole story and the testimonies, and then the high court offers her to admit, and if she wants to admit, she could get divorced and continue her life. If she maintains that she's pure, so we go with the whole procession of bringing her up and then taking her down, trying to get her tired, trying to get her to admit, trying to convince her that it's not so bad if she admits. Other people have messed up in this world, and that there's good, legitimate reason for a person to mess up. And maybe she should admit and save God's holy name from being erased if she maintains her purity. So we do the whole procession of uncovering her hair, taking off that special collar that would hold her robe together with a special rope that held her robe up. And notice Hevel HaMitzri. Mitzrim, what were the Mitzrim famous for? Asher besar chamorim psaram, their flesh is like the flesh of donkeys, v'zirmat susim zirmatam, and their ejaculation is compared to that of horses. Horses are known as animals that are very fruitful and have great prowess. So the Navi describes the Egyptians. So she's given a rope that's like the Egyptian rope, and we said really it's made from nitzarei dekel, from the leaves of a palm tree. And then the kohen gives the vow, and she says amen, amen. And we have the water that was prepared with the water from the kiyor. We described why specifically the water from that vessel that was made of the copper mirrors that the women, the pure holy women, donated. And we take some of the earth and we mix and we scratch off God's name. We write this whole parsha and we scratch off God's name. The coin scratches off God's name into that water. And once that name was scratched off, then we say, now you got to drink. Either admit or drink. Until that point, we tell her, you could say, I'm not going to drink. And that's it. We say, you're not going to drink. Okay, you didn't admit guilt, but by saying, I'm not going to drink, you've basically forfeited your ksuba and go home and you'll get a get for getting divorced. But once the name was erased, she can't say, I'm not drinking. Throughout this procession, we tell her, do you want to drink? She says, yeah, I want to drink. I'm pure. I did nothing wrong. Once the name was erased, we say, now you have to drink. Her only out at this point is saying, I'm guilty. I did wrong. Until that point, she could say, I don't want to drink. I don't want this procession. I don't want to drink. But once that point, once we reach that point, she can't say that. Then she has to either admit guilt or drink the water. And after she drinks the water, so if she was pure, then she'll benefit from that water. And if she was, if she really hadn't been pure, so then she explodes. Now, what did you want us to get back to? Remind me.
About if she's not guilty, how to make all the things she had to go through okay again. I mean, this is quite a balagan what she's then.
Well, she's going to get a good name. After, if she's innocent, then she's going
to
have children. And
she
everyone's
had to walk up the mountain. She was nearly, like, she was get, not nice anymore.
It's true, but this we say, she's getting because she wasn't completely modest. Her husband forewarned her. He told her, look, do me a favor. Don't allow yourself to be in a situation where you're alone with that person. And after she was warned, she was. So even though we said it could be a situation where they're in the basement, but then the husband and wife have to ensure that person shouldn't be in the house. A house is supposed to have four doors. Avram Avinu's house had four entrances. So four doors, I don't mean literally. Yeah. But Avram Avinu's house had four entrances. People could enter from all four sides. But there were doors. Doesn't say that there were four entrances and there was no doors. A house has to have doors. People have to know when to open the doors and when to close the doors. And who to open the doors to and who to close the doors to. So there's a famous story which you guys should know for your children. We're on the Midrash Tanhuma in this week's parsha about two twin sisters, that one had been unfaithful to her husband, and her husband had told her, go up to Jerusalem, we're going up. He warned her not to be with that guy alone, and she didn't listen, and something really happened there. And then he took her up to Jerusalem, and on the way she said, let me visit my sister. When she visited her sister, so she told her sister, look, I'm going to die if I go up there, so let's switch places. So her sister, it was a twin sister, they switched places. The twin sister goes up with her, they go up to Jerusalem, they ask her, did you do anything wrong? She says, no. Were you faithful? Yes. The whole procession, she drinks the holy water, and she walks out smiling. She says, you see, I'm okay, fine. They travel back, and she says, you know, let's stop by my sister. I want to tell her hello. She stops, she goes, and her sister tells her, thank you, you saved my life. Now, in ancient times, in time of Tanakh, and still in time of the Gemara, a kiss that was a kiss that showed connection was a kiss mouth to mouth. Any kiss that showed distance was a kiss on a cheek, on the hand. That was a kiss that showed a certain element of distance. The Malbim and the Ibn Ezra say that when it says Vayishak Le, when it says a kiss with the term Le, with the Lamed, to kiss, he kissed to someone, it means a distancing kiss, kiss on a cheek. When King David welcomes his son after one son, after Avshalom murdered his brother Amnon, so there were many years where they were distanced, and finally Avshalom made it back. So it says, Vayishak HaMelech le'Avshalom, the king kissed to Avshalom. So you read it on the surface, it seems like he welcomed him back, he gave him a kiss. The Malbim says, no, the other way around. Avshalom came forth and he wanted a sign that his father accepted him, and his father gave him a kiss on the cheek, something to show him, hey, enough. I'm not taking you all the way back in. You killed one of my sons. You killed one of your siblings. So over here, so the sisters met, and she gave her a kiss on the mouth. And the Medrash says that she still had some of that liquid that when she drank the sota, and the sister who really was impure, she exploded. So that's a story you should just know.
She just exploded. Huh?
You should just know because your kids are going to come home from cheder. The Rebbe will tell them that. Regarding hair covering, so we mentioned that the source for hair covering is in our parsha, but how nervous should a person be about hair covering? So today it's become accepted that women wear hair covering in the chasana. They walk into the cheder yichud if they're Ashkenazi, and then they say she's married, so she wears a hair covering. 100 years ago, no one did this. Women would get married, and after they got home, they'd start getting accustomed to wearing hair coverings. So first of all, a pointer to all you future chasanim, when a woman puts on a hair covering, the first thing she's going to be is conspicuous about how she looks. So you have to encourage her and tell her, honey, you look great. I don't care if she's wearing it right or wrong or upside down or right side up. Help her out, but you gotta encourage her. It's not easy for a woman. When a man gets married, he walks out. He's the same way he was yesterday. When a woman gets married, she walks out. Suddenly, she's different. Everyone sees her differently. She's an old hag, she feels. She feels, no, it's different. For women, for every woman. And this has nothing to do with whether she's a balas tshuva or anything else. She walks out, she suddenly feels more mature. Everyone knows she's married. She's wearing that hair covering. So first thing is you have to encourage them and tell them how good they look in it. And get them hair coverings that they look good in. That's why the Rebbe from Chabad was so for wearing wigs. Because he said, if you're going to get people to wear wigs, then women will want to cover their hairs because they look very, very good in wigs. So
better than when they do with the original hair.
Okay. So it's very important as a husband to encourage it. But as far as how nervous one should be about covering their hair. So today it's become accepted that women cover their hair in the cheder yichud. This wasn't the ancient custom. And a woman who doesn't want to, so firstly, if the Masader Kiddushin is Rav Bigun, you have to ask him. The rules in a wedding is that the person who arranges the wedding, he runs the show. So ask him if you want to. But you could also tell him that you heard from me and consult with him that Rav Avram Shapiro, when I spoke to him about it, so he said the girls all wear the veil that they cover their face with. Afterwards, when they dance, they throw the veil back over their hair. So he said, that's enough of a hair covering. So I said, but you could see the hair through the hair covering. What kind of hair covering is that? So he said, if you don't like it tough, throughout your married life, if your wife wants to wear that as a hair covering, she could. So I said, but why? You could see the hair. So he said, it doesn't say you're not allowed to see the hair. It says the hair has to be covered. The veil covers it. The fact that you could see through the veil is a different issue. Maybe that's a problem as far as making blessings or other things. I'm adding that point, that it might be an issue regarding other things, making a blessing in front of that hair. But the halacha says a woman has to cover her hair. She has covered her hair with that. And that explains, by the way, point to what we were discussing before. You see, whenever they have simchos, so the irreligious cousins come, and they give them these little veils that you could see the hair through them. So people always make fun of that. What kind of hair covering is that? Why do they do that? Well, now we understand why. Because you have a great sage who's saying that that's enough. The fact is that hair is covered. There are also opinions that say the woman doesn't have to cover her hair till she comes home that night. She doesn't even have to cover her hair. They went into the cheder yichud. So that's for our class on marriage. We're in the middle of going through the laws of marriage. When we get to that, maybe we'll have some time to discuss it. Yeah.
So it is also okay to have just a head on for women?
A woman is... One second. Her hair has to be covered. And there are opinions that say that she's allowed to have a tefach by a tefach uncovered lechatchila. Tefach by a tefach is a hand width by hand width. Now how you divide that? Hand width by hand width. Yeah? The area of one hand width by one hand width. You make a square of that. That's the amount of hair she's allowed to have lechatchila uncovered according to certain opinions. In Israel, those opinions... And some crowds are more accepted, and some crowds are less accepted. But that's the total amount of surface area of hair that's allowed to be revealed. So now, some women will take a tefach like this. They put a hand here, and they say, a tefach. That's not enough. Because width-wise, it's more than a hand's width. And the amount that they're allowed to reveal is a hand width by hand width area. Now, they could divide that along here. They could divide that along here. But at the end of the day, the amount of area that's allowed to be revealed is that area, according to this lenient opinion, which in the more religious crowds in Israel has not been accepted. In Israel, they don't accept it so much, in the more religious crowds. I don't like using that term, but for lack of a better term, we'll use that. But the Datilumi crowd, that's the regular Datilumi, what they don't call themselves Datilumi Haredi or anything else. The regular, you go to a regular... many times you'll see women wear a veil and they leave some revealed in the front or on the sides, and there's nothing wrong with that. They have what to rely on.
I read a book in
just a second, but going back to what you were asking, as far as is wearing a hat enough, So that depends on what's revealed. We said if she wears a hat that's like a veil that you could see through the holes a little bit, so that's a different issue. All the hair is covered, but something you could see through the holes. That's according to Avram Shapiro, that's okay. But if she's wearing a hat and she has a ponytail coming out, so that would probably be too much. I don't know how long the ponytail is, etc. But that would probably be too much.
Well, I was reading
just one second. Just sorry to cut you off again. Once we said that, I just want to point out that many times today they sell wigs of ponytails. So if you see a woman with a hat and a ponytail sticking out, it might not be her hair. Nowadays they sell wigs that way. There are hats that come with ponytails too. So,
is there anything right?
I'm just saying you shouldn't think just because you see a woman that way that there's something wrong. Could be it's perfectly okay. Yeah, sorry.
I was reading, I think, Mishnah Berurah downstairs. I'm Sephardic, I don't go by Mishnah Berurah, but I was just browsing through because I was. And it said there was an opinion that if a hair is sticking out of her head covering, she'll live a short, she'll die young, her family will die young. The whole thing,
Let's see it inside. The Gemara records that there was a woman who had she had children. She was the wife of a kohen, and Kimchit, if I'm not mistaken, was her name. And her children were all kohanim gdolim, high priests. So they asked her, how did you merit to have your children all high priests? So she said, I never let a hair stick out, even in my house. So today, many people are taught that a righteous woman won't let even a hair stick out, even in the house. But what we see from the Gemara is the exact opposite. We see from the Gemara that all the women let their hair stick out. All the women in the house didn't cover their hair. But this woman was exceptional, so she married it to have her sons, Kanin Dolim. So I wouldn't be too nervous about it. Rashi's opinion is that the women used to walk around in the house with uncovered hair, and even in the hallway, like where they'd meet the neighbors, they'd also go with uncovered hair. So halachically today, that's not how we act. I've never seen a religious home where when guests walk into the house, the wife is without a head covering. But if you look in the Gemara, it seems like in their times, it might have been accepted. So this is just to calm down frayed nerves.
Okay,
but,
quick question.
Just a second. But the custom and the appropriate way to act is that in the home, a woman, when there are guests, should definitely have her hair covered. She should not answer the door with her hair uncovered. And regarding her own children and her husband, whatever they want, they could do.
That was my answer.
About hair covering, it doesn't apply this rule about tefach, right? You like building the sukkah, you know. You're taking one.
Lavud.
Tefach, tefach. It's considered like.
The concept of lavud is halacha l'mishneh Sinai. It's a concept that we wouldn't say on our own, and it is only in relevance to mechitzot. When you want to have a mechitza, we're not trying to make mechitza between the woman and us or her hair and us. It's not the concept. Let's continue. So the kohen, when he's telling her the vow, he's saying, if you did not have an improper relationship, if you did not sleep with another man, is the literal translation of the psukim. So then may these waters be a blessing for you. Now, we all know why she's here. She's here because we're suspecting something else happened. But from here, we learn an important concept. We learn that potchin bizchut. When you begin, you should always present the positive first. And this applies to halacha also. In court cases, the first thing you judge, when you judge a person, is he chayv misa or not? Is he deserving of the death penalty or not? First, we have everyone making claims that, no, he's innocent. Maybe you don't have to punish him. This is the way a person should approach things. Try to put the positive, the first thing that you present should be the positive. Yeah?
Is it a mitzvah, one of the 613 mitzvahs for the Kohen to raise God's name?
I don't...
It says the Kohen should not be reluctant to raise God's name because it is a Torah commandment.
So
you want the 613?
I want to leave that for a Thursday night because you've mentioned a lot of terms which have to be defined. What does the word mitzvah mean? What does the word commandment mean? And what does the number 613 mean? And each one deserves a class in and of itself. Yeah. So I don't, it's not, just yeah, as an example, there are three opinions in Tosus what the word mitzvah means. And then there's another Tosus in the Ramban which discusses an aspect of the point you raised regarding the whole parsha of Sota. So this is a point which, if you want, we could discuss. I don't know if we're going to have class next Thursday or the following Thursday, but it's a worthwhile point. But we won't be able to finish it in one night here. Is it a mitzvah to divorce?
Ever sure. Online shurim.
Could be that if it's if the wife is no. Could be that if the wife does things that are that he has reason. It could be then. Yes, I have to check. I don't remember. It could be in that instance. Yes, I don't remember. right after the parsha of Sota, after the Torah tells us. After the Torah tells us this whole procession of the woman who is a sota. What does the word sota mean? To steer off the path. Sote is to steer off. Right after the Torah tells us this, the Torah tells us a new law. Concept of a nazir. Now, nazir literally means one who refrains, one who sets himself aside. The concept of nazir is based on another concept called neder. And the concept of neder is based on another concept called kedusha. So let's begin with kachim, go over to neder, and from neder go to nazir. The Torah tells us that with our speech we have power. And we could say this animal is going to have holiness to become a korban. And by saying that, that animal has a certain element of holiness. We impart with our speech holiness onto the animal. And that is the classical case of making something kachim, we make something holy, we make something, so to speak, it is now set aside for God. And that is one form of a neder. When one takes a vow, he could say, I will bring a sacrifice, and by taking on that vow, he is responsible. That's a classical neder. And one could make a neder, which we usually call a nedava. We say, this animal is going to be a sacrifice. And by doing that, the person makes that animal have that element of holiness that is going to, that is set aside to be brought as a sacrifice. Now the Torah says one could expand this and make a neder and say, this wallet is to me like a sacrifice. What did he do? He made this wallet forbidden to have pleasure, just like the animal, once it's set aside to be a sacrifice, you cannot derive pleasure from it. You're supposed to bring it up and bring it as a sacrifice. One can make a neder and say, this wallet is supposed to be to me like kachim. Now, we've discussed kachim, a neder of kachim. We've expanded it to neder that applies to inanimate objects. And neder derives from kachim. Then what the Torah tells us in our parasha is that there's another type of neder, and that is a neder of a nazir. A person can say, I want to be a nazir. God, I'm taking upon myself to be a nazir. And by saying that, he thereby becomes a nazir. What is a nazir? A nazir is a person who's responsible not to drink wine, not to eat grapes, not to eat raisins, not to eat water that grapes were soaking in. He has to distance himself from grapes and wine and grape derivatives and dry grapes, which are raisins. He's not allowed to become tameh. He's not allowed to go into a graveyard or be where there's a dead person. And he's not allowed to cut his hair. If a person just says, I'm a nazir, so stam nazirut automatically is 30 days. By just saying, I'm a nazir, we say the minimum is 30 days. Yeah?
What is, when he walks in the street, no one is staring at his carcass?
I'm not here.
What is when he walks by a dead body, there's no one else there?
Met mitzvah, so then if there's no one there to take care of him, so then he has to take care of him, he'll become impure and he'll start again. What? He's allowed to get married. He has every mitzvah he has like everyone else. The limitations are not to become impure, not to cut his hair, and not to drink grape derivatives. Okay? Everything else, like everyone else. So that's a nazir.
So it's basically like a kohen, as far as purity.
Kohanim used to shave their head. As far as purity is concerned, yeah. And Kohanim could drink wine. They just couldn't do service when they had drank wine. Our sages say, why did the Torah put these two parshiot adjacent? Right after telling us about this woman, the Torah tells us how a person can separate himself from wine. So our sages say, kol ha-ro'es ota bekilkula, anyone who sees this procession being done to a woman, that she has this rope tied around her and then the collar is open and all that, regardless of whether she comes out pure or not, that's not the point. She got to this stage where she's being disgraced this way. A person should take a lesson and say, I got to distance myself from wine. Why? Because wine brings a person to doing improper things with women. It's the thing that brings people down the most. And here we see many, many lessons from this point that Chazal tells. One lesson is that we know the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says, Ezeu chacham. What's a smart person? So you'd say, an encyclopedist, someone who knows the encyclopedia. Doesn't say that. Say, someone who studied in Harvard. Doesn't say that. It says, who's a smart person? Halomed, one who's learning. He's still learning. The Mishnah doesn't tell us he's attained the following knowledge. The Mishnah describes a smart person as one who is lomed, he is still learning mikol adam. He learns from every man. If you could learn from every man, then you're a smart person. Now sometimes you need a certain amount of knowledge before you could learn from everyone. And the more you know, the more you could learn from other people. But the definition of a zeh chacham, what's a smart person, is one who's learning. He's still learning. When we describe learning Torah, we always call it learning Torah. Even a person's own learning is called that he's teaching himself. He's melamedet atzmo. He teaches himself. Hu lilmod or no lilmod. Person has an option, I'll learn or my son will learn. We're always learning. And here the Torah tells us that we're supposed to learn from other people's downfalls as well. This poor woman, everything that happened to her, Torah says, learn from it. You see what happened? You're supposed to walk away and learn something. Usually when we see something happen, one of a few things happens. Either we say, that wouldn't happen to me. That's more often than not. That's what Rav Sadia Gon writes, says when people see other people die, so they say either, oh, he was much older than I am, or that's an exception, he was so young. People never think that, gee, that could have been me. But when we see other people, so we're supposed to stop. And when we see other people fall, we're supposed to learn from it. Rabbi Tendler quoted a Hasidish Rebbe, I don't remember who, said when Yosef was asked to lead the Egyptian people, the Egyptian advisors all said, have you ever seen such a wise person as he? What was so wise about him? So this Hasid Shrebi said what was wise about Yosef wasn't just the interpretation of the dream. It was the fact that Yosef said you're going to have 7 years of wealth and you should take the wealth of those 7 years and store it. Usually when people are making money, they think, I'm making money today, I'll be making money tomorrow. So let me spend what I'm making today. The natural inclination is always to feel like if you got money, you're going to have money. And for a person to be able to say, let's save money, because there are going to be 7 years where we won't have, where we won't have food, where we won't have money, that takes a smart person. So when people see other people fall, they should learn from it. We constantly see advertisements about people who, one of the spouses died and the family couldn't make ends meet. People should learn from it. It's a worthwhile thing to buy insurance. Person is supposed to learn from even other people's downfalls, and that's what we see here. He saw a sota, he should ask himself, how did he get there?
Good question.
And
as he's not allowed to drink any wine, he can get plastered on vodka?
Seems that way, yeah. A person is supposed to.
Vodka is no problem. I said it.
It says Yain v'Sheichal, but our sages understood Sheichal to be wine derivative, grape derivative. In Gemara, in Aramaic, Sheichal is beer. But in Tanakh, our sages understood that Sheichal is a different form of wine. Yeah?
How is going to make the Seder on Shabbat?
Oh, good questions. I don't know if we'll get to that tonight. Next Thursday.
Color. don't forget the first question I asked.
I will forget.
To get rid of the woman if he is just making it up. I asked before.
Ah, okay.
This was.
If he's making it up, so then hopefully he'll get caught beforehand. The question was asked if the husband just wants to get to bump his wife. So one of a few things could happen. Either the court's going to catch him, because the court is going to question his witnesses and is going to question everything. Or else she won't explode. In heavens, they'll take him to task for what he did.
Oh, okay.
But nothing, she won't explode. Even when one reads a newspaper, one is supposed to learn from it. If you do read newspapers, so you should get financial advice from the fact what you see other people going through. And even emunah, a person when he hears the news, he's supposed to learn from it as to how God's running the world. People should learn lessons from what other people have to other people physically also. Sometimes you see a guy going whitewater rafting or jumping off different areas where you think it's safe, and the guy gets hurt, and then you see 10 other people trying the same stunt. How many people have to die in motorcycle accidents for people to think maybe it doesn't make sense to own a motorcycle? But people always think I'll be okay.
My mother would love you.
But in that case, you have to stay in the room?
No, I'm sorry. Why don't... That's a good question. How does one... evaluate what's a worthwhile risk and what isn't. So let's leave that for Thursday night. Oh, it's a legitimate question, but you understand it's not a question we could answer in 2 seconds. Our sages told us that wine brings a person to downfalls with regard to women. And we see over here that that a person is supposed to think a step beforehand. It's not enough that a person says, I was stoned, I didn't know what I was doing. Well, who told you to walk into that bar? And that's why our sages always told us to distance ourselves. They said a person isn't supposed to partake of a party where there are non-Jews drinking wine. We're not allowed to do that. Now, this applies to parties at work or in college or just walking into a bar or going to a nightclub. And our sages also said a person has to be careful with his wife during the parts of the month when the husband and wife are prohibited from being together. So our sages said you have to be careful what you joke with your wife. You have to be careful about even when you sit down for a regular meal. Sages said, so put a sign on the table. Do something to remind yourself not to get too lightheaded. Again, a person is supposed to be smart enough to nip things at the butt, not to say, well, I got carried away. So don't get carried away. Catch it at the beginning. And that's the concept here. You saw where things got carried away. You saw what happened with this woman. So nip it at the butt. Don't let it get there. truth is, we're going too much overtime.
I have a question concerning Nazir.
Yeah, we didn't even finish Nazir. Give me 1 minute, let's finish summarizing the concept of Nazir. Person says he's going to be a Nazir, so the minimum is 30 days. At that, during those 30 days, he's forbidden to drink wine, grapes, raisins. He's not allowed to take a haircut. He's not allowed to comb his hair because hair will probably come out by doing that. He's not allowed to become defiled, impure. Let's say he's in a room when a person dies, so he has to get sprinkled like any other person who becomes impure. He has to go through the procession on the third day that we sprinkle from the water and the ashes of the paradum, and on the seventh day, and then on that seventh day he shaves off all of his hair. And on the eighth day, he has a special sacrifice that he has to bring. And he brings a carbon chatas, an ola, two young birds, and a carbon asham. And he starts from scratch, starts all over again. When he finishes his nezirut, let's say it was 30 days, so he comes to the Beit HaMikdash with three sacrifices. An ola, sacrifice that's going to be totally consumed by the fires for heaven. A chatas, which... he's bringing to atone for the fact that he distanced himself. According to one understanding in the Gemara, he's bringing it because, hey, God put you in this world to enjoy things in a holy fashion. And he said, I'm not taking any pleasure from wine. Well, you're supposed to take pleasure from wine. You're supposed to make kiddush. As a Nazir, he couldn't make kiddush on wine. He has to make kiddush on bread. As a Nazir, he can't do four kosos at the Seder. He has to do them on bread. Or maybe on beer. Or something else. On juice. But but he has to bring korban chatas, and he has to bring korban shlomim, a korban which holy part of it, and part of it will get burnt, and part of it will go to the kohanim. Together with this, together with the shlomim, he has to bring 20 types of matzah. There are 10 of one kind of matzah and 10 of another kind of matzah, which are going to be anointed with oil. What? Not chocolate matzah. No, it's specific matzah. We're not going into the description. That's okay. Not for tonight. How the matzah was made for the sacrifices. He brings the sacrifice of the chatas first, then the ola, and then he brings the shlamim. Now the shlamim he takes into a private room where he's going to cook it in a pot, like cooked meat. And under the pot he has a fire. And he first shaves off his hair. He shaves off his head. And then he takes from his hair and he pours some of the gravy onto his hair. And then he takes the hair and he puts it in the fire that's under the shlamim. Why? Don't ask me. It's what it says in the Torah. No, I don't know why.
No, and when I got there myself, I said, that must stink.
Hair burns very quickly.
But you ever burn your hair? It stinks.
Yeah, I didn't burn enough to smell it. I don't know. I tried it because the Mishnah describes whether you could use hair as a wick. And I wanted to see if it could soak up any oil and make it burn, but I never tried a bunch. I don't know. Okay, so God willing, we're going to have...